The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 32 from the Book of Serenity, Yangshan's Mind and Environment. Introduction. The ocean is the world of dragons. Disappearing and appearing, they sport serenely. The sky is the home of cranes. They fly and call freely. Why does the exhausted fish stop in the shoals and a sluggish bird rest in the reeds? Is there any way to figure gain and loss? The case. Yangshan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Yu province." Yangshan said, "Do you think of that place?" The monk said, "I always think of it." Yangshan said, "The thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls, and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thought to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there?" The monk said, "When I get here, I don't see any existence at all." Yangshan said, "This is right for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of person." The monk said, "Don't you have any other particular way of guidance?" Yangshan said, "To say that I have anything particular or not would not be accurate. Based on your insight, you only get one mystery. You can take the seat and wear the robe. After this, see on your own." So each one of us has put on the robe and sat down, each one of us taken our seat in the middle of life. We are looking, we are investigating. This practice of Zen is not like practicing something you know how to do. But this practice of Zen is investigating the truth of life, and the truth of your life, of my life, does not lie outside you somewhere. The truth of life is not in the words of others or ancient stories, but these stories are pointers, these teachings are pointers, and where do they point? But to right here. So we're not practicing some set of rules, although of course, we have these wonderful practices of sitting upright, spine erect, of returning to the breath, returning to this moment. These practices so helpful, but helpful as the entry point. And so this weekend, we're looking into this rather complex case, this complex story or folktale that has been handed down to us about some unnamed monk and the great teacher Yangshan. And these stories are not actually about someplace else, but about human life, about your life and my life. As Uchiyama Roshi said, everything you encounter is your life. So this story, as you meet this story, all the parts of it are you. The dragon that appears and disappears, the dragon that sports serenely, the crane that flies and calls, the exhausted fish in the shoals, the sluggish bird in the reeds, all of these are you. And of course, you are not some particular thing. If you try to pin down who you are, you will find it quite impossible, for anything you exclude puts you at some distance from what is actually happening. So you are Yangshan and you are the monk. And this story is taken from the 9th century in China. And one of the traditions at that time is once you ordained, and in China, you ordained to become a monk. There was no priestly ordination. You ordained to become a monk and shaved your hair and went and lived in a monastery. And there were these great training centers that arose in China in the 7th, 8th, and 9th century. And monks would train with a particular teacher, and then at some point the monks would go on pilgrimage to refine your understanding. You would go visit other monasteries, and if you were ordained, they had to take you in. It was kind of a lifetime tenure you had as an ordained person. And so this monk, as I dream into the story, this monk is wandering around on pilgrimage. He, like you and me, left home plate, left home base, and left once when he ordained. The ordaining is sometimes known as home leaving. Monks, and then later on in Japan, priests were called home leavers. And you would, when you ordained, you leave behind the familiar and enter into this new life. And so this monk had done that in entering the monastery and perhaps studied many years with his first teacher. And then once again, he left to go on pilgrimage. And this leaving is such an integral part of our life. The point of having a Zen teacher is not that you have found someone who knows what you should do. For no one knows what you should do. And even you can only know as you step into your life. And as we find, the point of life is not about learning how to make the right decision. I think one of the greatest disservices of our educational system is that we are encouraged to think there is a right answer and a wrong answer. And if we want to get the teacher's praise, we must come up with the right answer. But human life maybe is not so much about right and wrong. Human life happens in a much vaster context. And of course, there are things we do that lead to harmful results that we deeply regret and may feel ashamed of. But yet we did the best we could in that moment, and then we meet the next moment. The poet Antonio Machado said, you make the path by walking it. When we speak of the way, the Tao, the path, it's easy to imagine that there is some path stretching out in front of you, and you just have to figure out whether to turn right or left. But whether you turn right or left, you are on the path. On the harmony of relative and absolute, it says, if you do not see the path, you do not see it even as you walk on it. So you are walking the true path of your life, and there has never been one misstep. And I hope that we continue to learn and to grow in wisdom and understanding, and that we take responsibility for what we have done. Because our actions are our only companions, as we say, free to choose. And we choose, and then we step into that life. And whatever direction we go, we are moving into the unknown, and we are living right at the edge, living right at the center, we might say. I love Dogen's line, the true way circulates everywhere. Not one of your steps leads away from it. Taking action, not taking action, what is the right thing to do? Well, we do something, and doing nothing is doing something. And so here we all are doing nothing, so-called nothing, this vast nothing, this paying attention, this paying attention that requires some kind of leaving. This ancient technology, we might say, of intensive practice, which human beings have been doing for centuries and centuries, of stepping out of the everyday routine, leaving behind the to-do list to create this, this space, this sacred space and time. Of course, all time is sacred and special, but yet we human beings, the way we are constructed, we get caught up by a habit, and we get just this and just that, and we move to autopilot so quickly. So the point of home leaving, which you have done, which we all have done for this weekend, this weekend, we might say 3 days, but we might also say many lifetimes. Time and space get kind of elastic as we move into the world, as we step out of the world of calendars and figuring and analyzing and move into this world of experience. We might say the dream world, we might say the Sambhogakaya, the appreciation body of Buddha, where things manifest. We sit and we think we're just breathing in and out, and suddenly we are overcome by a sadness, overcome by irritation, overcome by something, and we don't know where it came from. It may be an ancient memory, something we hadn't thought of for years and years, something we had kept carefully in the back of the closet. We have all arranged our life to be as easy as it can be. And here, as we leave home and as we enter this sangha, this community of practice, we are opening up to what we have forgotten. We are opening to what we have put aside. And the teaching is that everything is necessary. We say over and over, this is not a practice of picking and choosing. We are not trying to maximize the good parts of us and minimize the bad parts of us. We are practicing allowing all of us to be here. I had a student once who got into a very intense argument with a friend of theirs and was telling me about it, was quite troubled. And he said, I'm not that kind of person who yells. And I said, well, actually, yes, you are. These parts of ourself, we can say, well, I'm not like that. Those people are so small-minded. Those are deluded people. Thank goodness I am not. I am this. You are limitless. You are everything. The brief stanza we read from Yuibutsu Yobutsu, that I love so much, just a few lines. An ancient Buddha said, the entire universe is the true human body. The entire universe is the gate of liberation. The entire universe is the eye of Vairochana. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. So this entire universe, not some small portion of it. And this is what the Buddha discovered as he sat under the Bo tree. He was looking into this great matter just as you and I are. And the teachings of Buddhism and the teachings of Zen are designed to help us see through the delusion of self and other. Our wonderful, our beautiful, exquisite human minds have been designed to create separation. There is me and there is the rest of the world. I am in here, you are out there. And this is a very useful device of the mind. Just like on your computer, there are so-called folders. And you can put documents in certain folders and look them up again. But I guarantee if you open up your computer, you will not see any tiny little folders there. Something else entirely is going on, but yet having your folders organized and files can be very useful. So too with the world. We create a world and move through it, and the world we create helps us navigate in some way. And as long as we don't think that we don't believe it, it can be very useful. And Yangshan in this koan is looking into this matter of subject and object. Subject is me, I see, I hear, I taste, I touch, I think, I am the one, the subject. And of course, as we all learned in English class, the subject needs an object. I see the light on the trees outside the window. I feel the coolness of the air inside the room we are sitting in. And so when Yangshan is meeting this monk, he first asks him, where are you from? This monk who is on pilgrimage. an introductory question, where are you from? He might have even asked, what is your native land? Where is home? A wonderful question on so many levels, and the monk answers it, we assume, in the realm of the practical, and he said, from Yu province. And Yangshan says, do you think of that place? Seeing what's here, what does this monk present? And the monk said, I always think of it. And one way to look at this, we talked about briefly yesterday as well. Of course, we don't think about one thing all the time anyway, so this monk is off base, but maybe he's responding to something deeper. Maybe this true home, do you think of your true home? Do you long for your true home? And this longing for something is such an essential part of our practice and is in this neighborhood we were talking about on Friday of bodhicitta, the sometimes called the way-seeking heart-mind. This path of Zen is not for the faint of heart. And we can read some of the teachings and read that, attachment is the cause of suffering and I shouldn't want anything and it's right here. But unless we really want something, unless we long for something, and it might be something we've had a glimpse of, or we might be longing for something we can't even imagine. Longing for a peacefulness, longing for an ease in this world of difficulty and suffering. Where, what is it that you long for? And of course, we can dismiss our longing, thinking, well, this is the problem. I just won't want this. But I think all of us desires something, and we might call it freedom or awakening. We might call it God. We might call it liberation. Doesn't really matter. But I do think all of us human beings, on some level, have this longing to be fully alive, to connect, to touch and be touched. I certainly do. And so this monk saying, I think about it constantly, maybe he might have said, it comes back again and again. And maybe for you and me, what is it that comes back again and again? What is it you really long for? I had a coaching client once who said that he longed for a place on the coast of Maine. And I asked him, what would that give you if you had a house on the coast of Maine? And he said, it would give me a view of the ocean. And I said, and what would that give you? Because there are many people who have views of the ocean who are not so happy. And he said, it would give me a feeling of contentment and peace. And so I suggested that what he really wanted was not some physical thing, not some particular thing, but some sense of this ease and peacefulness. Now, dangerous territory here, because we say, well, if you're just doing your practice to calm down, this isn't true practice, and you should want nothing, do nothing. And yet that is only half the equation, to remember what you long for. Might even say to remember what you are here on this planet to do. Your time is brief. My time is brief. How are you going to spend your life? And we can get so carried away by the everyday cares and concerns, by the burdens and responsibilities and the have-tos. It is an act of courage to come on a retreat like this, because the things that burden us are also the things that keep us relatively stable. Like, I know who I am. I'm the one who has too much to do. I'm the one who has to do this and has to do that. And we come here and we sit in our chair, sit on our cushion. And who are you when there is nothing to do? And who are you when you're not picking and choosing and not trying to say only this and not that? And so this is all connected, as some of us said on Friday evening, to home and coming home, leaving home, leaving the familiar, to find some true home that is not contingent upon particular conditions. Many years ago, one of our members was making up a flyer, I think, to go out in the community, and he came up with this this idea of a welcome home. And this is actually what is on our website now. You click on boundlessway.org, and it says welcome home. This is our practice to welcome ourselves, to allow ourselves to be at home here. And to be at home here means pitching your tent right where you are. So if you are in the desert and everything is dry and arid and barren, then how do you make your home where it is dry, arid, and barren? Or if there's great bolts of lightning and huge storms sweeping through you, how do you make your home right in the middle of the torrential rain and the thunder and lightning? So this monk is wandering around, and maybe in his wandering, maybe lonely for the old monastery, maybe missing his buddies and missing the routine, but maybe he's saying, this true home, I'm always thinking, where is it? Where am I? And Yangshan goes on to this wonderful exploration of the subject and object of the self and the world. He is talking about the teaching that is called in traditional Buddhism Pratichu Samuppada, the dependent co-arising. And it is the teaching that the self and the world create each other. Usually we think the world is like some stage, that we're born onto the stage and we play our part, and then the play goes on without us. And some truth and usefulness to this perspective, but also we are here we live in the world that we create. We live in the world that comes to us through our minds, through our senses. The self is not separate from the world, and the world is not separate from the self. I looked at several translations of the koan, and Yangshan says the thinker is the mind and the thought of is the environment. And then in all the translations, the next sentence is, therein are the mountains, rivers, land masses, buildings, towers, etc. And at first I thought, oh, he's talking about the environment, the world out there, the object. Therein are the mountains. But as I sit with it longer, I see therein includes the mind and the world. This gives rise, this interaction gives rise to the 10,000 things. And to begin to see this arising, to see that what is seen is not separate from you. Hungjer, in the passage we read today, Field of Boundless Emptiness, he says, the subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. So mind is the subject, the self, I. Mind and dharmas, are objects, things of the world. So mind and objects emerge and harmonize very naturally. This is the harmony of the relative and the absolute, the subject and object. And so we look into this arising. A thought arises, and Yangshan encourages the monk to say, how does the thought arise? What is this arising? In Dawi encourages the student who claimed to be dim and dull. He says, does the one who recognize you are dim and dull, is that one dim and dull? So all kinds of thoughts, all kinds of images, all kinds of feeling states arise in the mind. And yet they arise and pass away like dragons in the sea. Useful to know that that's an automobile going down the road and not to go out into the road. But yet the one who sees the automobile, is the automobile outside you or inside you? Who is the one who is thinking? Who is the one who is seeing? We could also say, what is this thing that I am seeing? What is this object? And the object, not necessarily just a tree or a thing, the object can be the story I'm telling. And so subject and object come together, and we call this life. So the monk looks into this, and Yangshan said, what do you find when you look here at the juncture of self and other? And the monk says, nothing at all. No boundaries, no things, no objects. There is just this moment of aliveness. And this is an astonishing insight. This is not an observation that Yangshan or the monk take lightly. To see into the coming and going of everything, this appearing, this object and subject meeting and touching, and in this moment, this is the two arrows meeting in midair. And yet, this is not the end of the journey. to see into this coming and going, to see into this boundlessness, no edges. There is something yet to do, which involves entering into our life, back into our life of cooking food, of aching legs, whatever is here. And this is where Yangshan leaves the monk. And I think I will leave us all here too, in the vast confusion, the vast clarity, the tender project here together. Please don't think you can understand it or need to understand it, but to look for yourself, to look and look, to use what is here, to trust what is here. This is the entry point. This is your true home. Thank you. So please sit comfortably, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. Looking further into this matter. Madhu.
Thank you for your talk, David Rossi. So, you know, what came up for me is how we leave home in order to return back home, right? So true home is not something that's different from this very home, these four walls, you know, because wherever we go, that's our home, right? And it makes me wonder, like, what's the difference between first time being home, before starting the practice, and then coming back home? But I, when I, even when I have that thought, I just have this sense of lightness, a little bit of, you know, sense of freedom, that, you know, at least my fist, our fist is not as tightly clutching, maybe just a little, holding things a little less tightly. And yeah, even that just feels so profound.
Well, that teaching about returning home and seeing it for the first time, it permeates world literature. Everywhere you see that in world religion, it's a very it's a tender and true feeling that you're expressing, Madhu. And you know, we talk sometimes about the Zen circle, the 360 degrees of a circle. Zero and 360 are the same, right? Once you've traveled all the way around the circle, there you are again, you come home. But everything's been changed by that journey. So I think you're pointing to something very true and something that you can think about, but to actually experience it. And the nice thing about circles is we can do it over and over and over again, keep leaving home and then returning. And every time, oh, this, more and more and more. This is really, if there's a Zen path, it's a circle or cyclical in some way. Yeah. Thank
great.
You.
Thanks, Mundu. Craig.
Thank you for your talk, David. I perked up when you talked about, quoted the poet saying, you make your path by walking on it. And then it resonated again towards the end as you talked about co-creating our reality, that we walk the path, we make it. I've walked paths in the woods and made paths, and they become ruts. And that made me think of yesterday, as Melissa talked about perpetuating trauma by carrying it on again. And I was thinking, you know, these could be paths that take us towards awakening. These could be paths that take us back towards past trauma. The metaphor sort of breaks down at that point. But What little I know about brain science is, we make neural pathways as we think a story over and over again. We group make a groove in our brain just like the path in the woods, but we can make a path that takes us into awakening too with the practice of breathing and the body muscle memory of sitting. So
Exactly.
yeah,
lots of paths.
And thinking about the neural pathways, some of the research I've read talks about once a path is established, if you try to break it, it just adds more energy to that pathway. But we can cultivate these new paths. And certainly we are training ourselves in some way. We are practicing what happens if I let things be. If I don't make a plan. And so we get better at not planning. We get better at appreciating which are real paths, we can say, not ones that we know where it's going to lead. And maybe we become more comfortable with the path emerging and get to enjoy that.
And I love how you call those old paths. They're very robust, the neural pathways, and they're like ruts. I once had a mindfulness student who had been a farmer, and then he became a neurologist. And his way of talking about those neural pathways that was that they were like cow paths. That if you see a path that cows have made on a farm, they meander. They don't make sense. So to get the cow from the field to the barn, there's a straight line to do that. But the cow paths always meander, and he realized it was because the cows were going around trees and bushes and boulders that no longer existed. Right. And that's like us too. We're so stuck in these robust neural pathways, but they don't make sense anymore. They actually don't fit anymore. There's other ways to get where we want to go. So this is what, I think you're on something, and David was affirming it, that these pathways that we now create that are about that Zen gives us the possibility of not going around trees and bushes and rocks that no longer exist, to see through that and to see that they're just remnants of some old understanding.
And Craig, I want to also point back to what something David said in his talk is that none of the paths, we can assume that it was wrong path to here, but none of the paths that have brought us here were wrong. We can create new paths, we can look, but to look at all the paths, there is no wrong path. There's a path that we create, there's a path that we can choose to make deeper, but each path. As you're also quoting Dogen saying that none of your footsteps leads away from it. It's you're here.
Yeah,
Yeah,
great.
thank you.
Thanks. Marcus.
Thank you very much for the talk, David. I think it was what arose for me was I think at the start of Sasheen, I had told myself, I'm not going to have any expectations and set any goals. And I think what that really meant was, as long as it's the way I want it to be and it's happy and peaceful. And that's I think yesterday was a great realization as it was the exact opposite of that. It was very very, everything in my life that I'd say I wouldn't want to have play in the story was unraveling things I really didn't even remember. And I think the more I tried to fight that and turn it into the happy story, it just was essentially adding gasoline into the fire. And instead of just understanding that, like Michael just said, those are both parts of my life, and they're both my path of the things I want and the things that I also maybe I don't want to think about all the time. But it was a good realization.
Why did you stay, Marcus?
That's I something tells me to. I have to just because it wasn't yesterday was very hard when I went to bed and even woke up. I felt like I might be going crazy, and it I think it it's good to work through it. I think I would have been more frustrated if I didn't stay, because I think it's easy to stay through the good things when you're happy and blissful, and you have rays of light shining on your head. No one wants to leave then, and I think it's getting through some of the things that, like you said, David, are bottled up in a closet or a storage bin that we haven't really exposed in some time to our awareness.
So a kind of determination and courage, which are required on this path. I'm so glad you did, and I think all of us here can recognize the territory you're talking about. Yeah, great.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Marcus. Eugenia.
Thank you for your talk, David. Yeah, I have been reflecting on that home topic for a long time. And during your talk today, I realized what if the human condition is being homeless? And what came to mind was Plato's word that we are just broken half, searching our entire life for the other half. And would it be so bad to accept that that's the human condition? And the moments we feel home, they're just impermanent. And you might have this is it moment, but being aware that it might not last. So thinking about people who had their fantasies coming true, like went to a monastery or bought that house in the ocean and figure out, but that was not. And the other thing that came up is how important is the human touch. Thinking about one of my clients who said that was a fantasy being touched by, as therapists, we are told never to even handshake with clients. And
So, Eugenia, actually, I want to keep you on the first point. Let's
yeah.
not go on to the second here,
Okay.
because I think it's really important, this feeling of homelessness, and how we can latch on to something, and think, oh, I finally got it. Now I finally have. But I think you're right about this. It's not going to come as we think it should or might. Whether we go to a monastery or have a house on the coast of Maine. So then we make our home in homelessness, right? We make our home alone, right where we are.
And you were talking, Eugenia, about other people, but what I'm hearing from you is this is true for you. This is something you've recognized yourself. You feel homeless, yeah? And so that's so important to own that. Even if it's true that everyone feels that, part of this way of practicing is to say, yes, I feel this way, and really look into it with great curiosity and wonder, what is it? What is it for me? What does it feel like? Once you do that, once you get to know that, then you can look out and it's no longer theoretical about these other people. You feel the empathy. Oh, we're all lost. We're all wandering around on pilgrimage. Me too. This the owning of the I is also a big part of this practice. Yeah. So
Great.
thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
sharing that.
I'm just going to add too, is Eugenia, this David brought up this word longing quite a bit in his talk, and I really appreciate that because there is a link too to the word belonging, between longing and belonging. And so that this longing is part of our the human condition of one of just draw to coming to home, and but never, at some level, never quite getting there, but there that connection that's always there underlying the longing and the belonging.
Yeah,
Yeah.
wonderful. Thank you. Chris.
Thank you for the talk. Thanks for the talk, David. So many wonderful beacons, like longing and belonging. I was gonna work with that word, longing. But overall, how we navigate, practice this coming and going, with our practice that we talk about and work with all the time. What's really striking me these days is sort of a force feeding of practice, which is death. I lost three dear colleagues and friends this past year, one just a month ago, very unexpected. And I think we're all familiar with that experience of oh, I can't call that person anymore.
Yeah.
And not quite believing it, not having it land in ourselves. And of course, there's birth on the other end too, you know, that state of this newborn infant, which I've already moved past with my grandson, who's becoming an old man, approaching age two.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, we're familiar.
There's something about coming home in a very new way that you just have to hold because you can't explain it. So,
well, you know, as I'm listening to you, Chris, I'm so struck by how hard it is to stay with, like we were pointing out to Eugenia, this is actually your experience, losing three dear friends, the grief that's arising and how quickly it goes to us and you. And then to bring it back to the I, this is deeply personal. When we say, you know, I am of the nature to have ill health, to grow old, to die, to really, really own that. That's such an important part of our liturgy for that reason, that it's so easy to, we have so many ways of avoiding that. And you're being force fed, right? I love that. It's just like, take one more, like your 2 year old grandchild, right? You know, come on, here comes the airplane. The spoon goes in. Our granddaughter now, she's very clear when she doesn't want to eat. She just picks up food and throws it on the floor and grabs her bib and takes it off. She doesn't have words yet, but she can say no to things. And so this is an important part of how the universe takes care of us. This is bodhicitta again, arising as reality. You know, my loved ones, when I worked at hospice, we used to joke, because we sometimes had to, because we were so surrounded by death, about phone calls from the dead. The phone rings and I think, oh, that's my mother, that's my brother. And it hasn't been, and won't be. And it takes a while for minds to be brave enough, courageous enough in a way. I think grief work is courageous to say, things are different. Where's my new home? Right, going along with this, how can this path lead me home? This is what I work with this all the time myself, and then I can see it in others. So thank you for sharing the depth of that sorrow and the habit mind that takes us away. It's perfect.
And also the point is, if you don't do Zen, you're not going to avoid it. You can think, well, this is too hard. I'm just going to keep everything in the closet.
I'm going home.
But life comes to us, and the teachings of impermanence and the teachings hit us over the head, and in some ways we're facing into them here instead of turning away. And I'm reminded of some religious teacher who talked about dying before we die, to die again and again so that we can live. In Zen we say shigyo practice. We die to our old self. We die to the way we would like it to be. And in this dying, then we are reborn again and again and again. And it's not some sweet, easy formula, but the tears of the deepest heart and great loss. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. Brad.
Thank you, David, for it's quite a journey, this talk. I feel like we're in a commercial break right now, and it's a cliffhanger, and I want to have you wrap up the teaching. we were right in the middle of the big drama of subject and object. And then he's given some instructions, and I'm not quite sure. It seems like go sit on your cushion and stay with your practice. But do you have any, should we make a pilgrimage to Worcester on Monday afternoon and
do some yard work?
Yeah. Absolutely. No, Brad, so and we all step into the place of the monk, say, okay, I get it, but tell me the real teaching here. And you're exactly right. This other part of you says, oh, sit on your cushion and be with your breath. This is the great secret instruction. We didn't want to say it too early in the retreat. it's not hidden, and no one can give it to us. In the dim and dull reading, he says, just look and look, right? And how do we look and look? By coming back again and again to the breath, by being simple, by giving up whatever we think we've gotten. And then we are in the pivot, and we cannot, William Blake said, you cannot storm the gates of heaven. So whatever strategy you have for getting the big ring, the big golden ring, no need to worry about that. Just sit and sit, homeless forever. Let us all joyfully practice for 5,000 kalpas.
And you know, there's many, many stories, and you're enacting one now, but you're enacting the very story that's in this koan where Yangshan gives him this incredible teaching. And then he says, yeah, but do you have any guidance for me? Right. I can't tell you how many times that happens to me in Toksan, where, you know, I give a teaching to somebody that seems to fit, and they say, yeah, but what should I do? What can I do? And of course, there's no guidebook. There's no way to understand what to do next. You make the path by walking. And what happens is that Yangshan says, you know, and it's translated in all these different ways, but basically, put on your clothes and do what's next. That's how you find the answer to this particular mini series that you engaged in. Yeah, there are no commercial breaks in Zen. Yeah, just the story continues, but now you're the hero.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. So maybe last one, Sabrina.
So you're telling me that all of this is a construction of the universe through me. I made up Zen practice. I made up this computer, but it's also real. I don't know. I'm feeling, I guess, a little silly right now.
But it's wonderful.
Yeah,
you know,
thank you.
Da Wei says at the end of his little text, you'll laugh out loud, right? There's a lot of that in these teachings. They're absurd. And the thing is that there, I think Michael said this yesterday, there are different views of reality. So there is the co-creation view, right? That that I co-create the world with my consciousness. And, you know, the reality of that for me is that things can happen, and I can put a boundary around them and fit them back into old narratives of mine. And then I'm making up, so I'm upset about something, but I basically made that up. I don't know what's going on with the other people who said and did things. This is the negative side of co-creation. The other thing I can do is I can say, oh, you know what? I really am a person who loves to work out. I'm going to do my workout this morning. You know, so we're constantly playing around in that realm of co-creation through the power of our minds, really. And, You know, if you are walking along one of these cow paths and you come across one of the rocks and you decide to walk right into it, you'll hurt your toe. That's also, that, you know, ow is a big part. So David was talking about the Sambhoga Kaya, sometimes it's called bliss body, the appreciation body is how he translated it, appreciation body of the Buddha. That's in this dreamlike realm where, you know, we can actually see how we're co-creating things. But there's also the Nirmanakaya, which is the activity body. From that view, you didn't make the computer. You didn't. But everybody in the universe did make it. All the people in the factories hurting their little hands, and the people making tons of money off of us, and, you know, and whoever, all that. There is a way of seeing even that as I'm part of that. You know, I'm connected to all these things that happened that resulted in this thing, you know, that is letting us be together. So that's the Nirmanakaya. That's how this koan ends too. Put on your big boy pants and go out and do what you need to do. Come on, enough of this. And this is what we do, right? And then there's this other way of looking at things where you can't pin anything down. The mind just fails at this point. And this is what we were talking about yesterday about shunyata, thusness. There are no computers, there's no death, there's no birth, there's no you, there's no me. So you can't, in practice, we have openings to these views. But if we enter them from the experience of the opening, we get some insight into how life actually occurs. But if we enter from David just said, or Michael just said, or Melissa just said, I don't know, that doesn't make sense. That's the world, the theory coming before the actuality. There's a related koan to this that we almost did because it happened to one of Yangshan's students, where they're talking about this very thing. And the teacher says, you know, it's like a horse in a cart. If the horse stops, do you hit the cart? Right? You always go for what's alive. That's how things work. So, yeah.
And the Zen that you practice is Sabrina Zen. The Zen that I practice is David Zen. Because if I try to practice Sabrina Zen, I'm going to be in trouble because it's not going to be true. And so each one of us finds our own way. It's not that there's nothing out there, right? And it's not like, oh, I'm just making it up, but something is meeting. You are being met by something, right? And in that meeting place is the spark, is life itself, and the whole, the universe, the computer, the trees all come out of that place of meeting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Yeah, perfect questioning.
Thank you.
So let's come back to our Zazen posture for a few more breaths, and then we'll move into our next practice.